questions, comments? I'd love to get feedback.
We've got a lovely volunteer in the audience with a microphone, so if you could put your hand up high and wait for her to pass you the mic, that'd be great. So are there any questions?
How much corporate opposition did you experience in the process of making the food? Because obviously there are a lot of vested interests involved in the way that, for lack of a better word, was manipulating our society's perception of things. As there's so much money involved in it, did you as a filmmaker actually experience a lot of difficulty in making this film once it became apparent what you were doing?
While I was making it, Michael Moore started working on Sicko. And when the drug companies were pretty wary. I mean, in terms of getting access, it's really hard to get the drug companies. They have always been wary. But when he started making Sicko and going around saying that he was going after the pharmaceutical industry, they wouldn't talk to anybody. I mean, I couldn't get any more interviews after that. Because there have been memos that have been going up saying, don't talk to any filmmakers, because he sometimes uses stringers. So that really affected the access. I mean, I was able to get this access because I worked for them. I mean, and I wasn't really planning to do an expose. I had already been working on an experimental film on how science had looked at women and sexuality at the time. I was working on that. But I had never heard of female sexual dysfunction when I took that job. Which raised some concerns for me because I'd been reading all these books about the history of hysteria and all these other diseases. And nobody ever mentioned this. So it got me curious. But in terms of opposition that I personally experienced, I was never intimidated or anything like that, no. It was just difficult to get access, I would say. Yeah.
First, I just want to say that you should be congratulated. This is an amazing film. Shocked, and I'm so glad that we included this in because, you know, she's a guest expert now on Oprah. She's on every week, and she never once mentions anything about pills or drugs or anything. It's all about relationships and all about the social context. So it's interesting for me to see the shift in where she started out and what she's telling 8 million people every time she's on Oprah. Which brings me to the second point that I found so interesting was that the people that you talk to have, it's so amazing that there was almost irony when they were speaking to you. I mean, they knew what they were doing was problematic, right? Even the woman who you spoke to, the pharmaceutical Vivas, that woman, I just couldn't understand how she could speak to you in a straight face like that. I mean, there was something about even them recognizing the paradox and the irony in what they were saying to you. So I don't know if you can comment a little bit on how you got people to speak so openly. It's just so striking. I've never seen that in any documentary where people know that what they're saying is bullshit. And then just the one last thing, is this film going to be available for distribution in classrooms?
Yeah.
Or anywhere else? And thank you.
Yeah. So in terms of distribution, we're just starting out. This is our premiere, as Greg's saying, so we don't know where to go. But there's definitely a goal to get it out to schools and use it as an educational tool. There's talk, I've been working with the Policy Institute at Dartmouth College, the medical school there, and they're talking about trying to get to the United States in the medical school curriculum nationwide, because they're not really taught about sexuality and sex education in medical school. They get about 10 hours in their entire time in medical school. And that's how you deal with patients who have AIDS, or how you deal with patients, you know, who are transgender. I mean, sort of how you, you know, relate to patients around sexuality, but not so much dealing with things like sexual problems. So we want to try and get into the medical school curriculum. In terms of, I was kind of surprised too when I started interviewing everybody about this disorder and about what they were doing. I mean, I think that part of it is that the subject themselves knew better and they were conflicted in terms of what they were doing. There's also a certain discomfort around sexuality, and so them talking about it sometimes revealed what they were really thinking in ways maybe talking about other things that are more scripted. And also, I didn't deal with PR people. I went to, you know, the managers of clinical research, the founders, the CEOs. I didn't deal with the people that had the scripts. And so they're real humans, and you see that. It's not like they've been told what to say. And so I think that's what comes out. They haven't sort of perfected the spiel yet, basically.
Sorry, it's up here. Question up here. I also want to thank you for an amazing film as a sex educator myself, and I was kind of a piggyback question to Laura Berman. I've seen a number of sexual health organizations endorse her for her perspective on young people learning how to pleasure themselves and not depending on men. But I always had a problem with the way that she approaches that subject, because There have been a few reports released recently that say it's total junk science. It says that if you have sex under the age of 18, you will have some sort of psychological disorder your whole life. which is totally promoting and supporting abstinence-only education and the funding towards that in the US. It's crazy. But I was wondering about, I guess, your perspective on younger people's involvement in understanding orgasm and pleasure being an equitable part of sex education, because we don't have that. We have great sex education in Canada, depending on where you look, not in a lot of places, but in Toronto we certainly have advanced, but pleasure still isn't a huge part of that. So I'm wondering your perspective, or if you were able to talk to anybody who was under the age of 20 or under the age of 18, and that we don't keep reserving this knowledge about orgasms for people who are older or in university settings or academia.
Okay, this is a debate going on right now in the United States, because we still have a lot of abstinence-only sex education. And there's a real attempt to try and get comprehensive sex education. I mean, it was surprising to me when I was making this documentary how few women knew about clitoris, how few women knew the statistic that 70% of women need clitoral stimulation, direct clitoral stimulation, in order to orgasm. And even my interns were like, oh, I'm okay. You know, there's just this moment at certain stages when we're working on it. And I think that, and the other thing is that they don't teach, which I've been really surprised to find out, but they don't teach homework assignment to go home and find their clitoris. I came in the next day, she said, "Sir, everyone, find their clitoris," and we're just giggles. She knew they were okay. So, you know, I think that this is, because we don't have comprehensive sex education, I mean, in the United States and in a lot of other countries, it just makes us a lot more vulnerable to messages that the media can give us about what our sex lives are supposed to be like, and, you know, this sort of medicalization of sexuality, we actually start to think we have a disorder, when in fact we may not know where our clitoris is, and that's the problem. So, and then this is why the type of work you're doing around sex education is so important. Therapy as a form of treatment for sexual dysfunction. There is sex therapy, and Leonor and also Laura Berman, sex therapist. And I think that certainly, you know, that sex therapy can work. That talking through these things, as Leonor says, it's a homework assignment when you go to see her around sexual problems. You get one more sexual event a month. You don't need to take a patch. In terms of studies, I haven't done any research to see if there have been any studies that actually show the efficacy of therapy. I think that would be something to look into. I was thinking about putting in the film, but it was getting very full of information. And so I think that that's a very, very open in terms of the efficacy. I don't know.
All right, your film started with you looking into the adult film industry for a bit as a consultant. I was wondering if you're able to find out the effects of the adult film industry on women's sexual health, if you found anything out in your research. Kind of an aside.
That was not something that I looked into. I mean, I know that they've been doing studies where women are watching pornography and then they're in MRI machines and they're seeing that they're getting, you know, blood flow going to their genitals. So, I mean, and from what Beavis found out, I mean, pornography does seem to elicit sexual responses, but in terms of looking at the range of pornography and the effects on our understanding of sexuality and us as sexual beings, that was not something I was studying. And so I think that there's been a lot of books written about that kind of thing, but this documentary wasn't particularly examining that.
I just have a comment. I'm an endocrinologist. Testosterone has been around for a long time and has been used off-label for a long time by women. The big barrier is hair growth. Women don't like that. So, and in terms of perspective on FDA approval, less and less drugs are being approved by the FDA, but that doesn't really mean anything, as I'm sure there'll be backdoor approaches to get testosterone sprayed. People can already use androgel in baby doses for women. And just a question for you, how well is Intrinsa doing in Europe?
It's very interesting. You know, it's tricky, like, around this off-label use. There's just an article in the New York Times about EstroTest, which is a combination of estrogen and testosterone, which is available. But it was promoting an off-label use. And doctors, you're right, have been prescribing testosterone for many, many years. In fact, it was very popular in the 40s. And then it was something, I think, that had a resurgence more recently when they were looking for sex drugs yet again. But there are no clinical trials that show that it's actually efficacious. So I actually think it's problematic that doctors are prescribing testosterone off-label. And that, you know, estrogen is being promoted for off-label use around sexual desire. Because when you look at Procter & Gamble's trials, and they tested this on thousands of women, they found that it was not working. And these drug companies, as you can see, they'll try every combination. Well, she doesn't have her ovaries, we'll give her estrogen, then make it work. You know, I mean, they're really trying to get these drugs to work. So I think off-label prescribing really needs to start to be examined a little more carefully, because it's getting so many drugs now are being prescribed off-label without there being really good clinical trials to actually show that these things are working. So it's very tricky. And in terms of how Intrinsa is doing in Europe, it's interesting, they don't have direct-to-consumer advertising in Europe. And Procter & Gamble, when they took on developing Intrinsa, they said, we are only going to be working on things that are billion-dollar brands. So they thought that Intrinsa was going to be a billion-dollar blockbuster. But that really counted on it being approved in the United States. Why? Because here we have direct-to-consumer advertising. And they knew that they could get it out as like the next Viagra, the female Viagra that we've all been waiting for, when even though they'd only tested it on like a small little group of women. And I say that because that's what the marketing was at the beginning. And they signed a $100 million advertising campaign. There aren't that many women who have radical hysterectomies to warrant that kind of advertising campaign. So they, I believe they were really hoping for, you know, an off-label kind of thing that would be going on. Now, in Europe, they don't have direct-to-consumer advertising. So initially, when Intrinsa was released, there was a flurry of articles in the paper that said, you know, the love patch is finally here, you know, things like that. Love is only a patch in the bottom. They just had a lot of different headlines. But after that, they couldn't advertise. So they were dependent on the media to write about them. The media got bored and moved on to the next story. And so last year, they only had $2.5 million in sales of Intrinsa in the EU. It's not doing well, because they've nationalized healthcare, which we don't have, and doctors are less likely to do off-label prescribing there because of that. So.
You said you were doing some activities. Anyway, you're doing some activities in on the film at 6 o'clock yesterday morning. What were those activities? What I mean to say is that, you know, I don't know how these films are put together, and this would be an insight as to what are the last kind of things.
It's a lot of work. Basically, I was at an online house in New York City, and we've been doing the color correction. You know, I've used different cameras over here, so we're trying to match all the color and each shot to sort of match up. And when you do that, you put in your audio that you've gone and you cleaned up and you mixed and you put in your music, and we're trying to get it out to master to a tape so I can show it to you here, get it all together. And they're having trouble with it. So we ended up being up all night trying to get a clean copy out of it and get everything out. So luckily, we were able to do that. It's a little stressful. Yeah. Any other?
The FDA already recognizes female sexual dysfunction as a disease. Is the genie already out of the bottle? Like, is it only a matter of time until a drug company gets the votes or markets hard enough or finds that magic combination? Is it already too late? Can you undo that?
That's such a complicated question. I wish I knew the answer. I think that so the FDA has recognized female sexual dysfunction as a disorder, but it's a developing disorder, interestingly. They had some hesitation initially as thinking of it as a disorder, but finally they did, and as soon as they issued the guidance to industry saying this is a disorder, that's when everything took off. And so it's developing. Does that mean it could, you know, grow backwards and undevelop? I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting question. I know that Leonor Tiefer has gone in there to talk to them. I think it might, with this new administration, there may be some potential for change around that. You know, all the other, I think, you know, there is a little hope there. There have been 12 drug companies now that have dropped out of the race. It's been very difficult for them to show meaningful benefit over placebo because the placebo effect is so extremely high on these types of medications, which tells us something about the psychological element of it all. And so it's going to be interesting to see if a drug company is actually able to come up with something that will really work. Libby Gel, which is this testosterone, is something that may end up being improved. They always claim that they're having really good results in their clinical trials. So we'll wait and see, basically. But we'll definitely use the film.